This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Mark Klobas, your host for the channel. Today, I'm talking with Audrey Waters, author of the book Teaching Machines, The History of Personalized Learning. Audrey, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for agreeing to be on our podcast. I was wondering if you could start us off by telling our listeners something about yourself.
I'm a writer. I write about education technology. I'm known as EdTech's Cassandra, which I did not choose that name for myself. People who are familiar with the mythological figure would probably understand why. But I tend to look around at EdTech today and say, folks, this doesn't look great. I guess I would say I do prophesize a lot of doom when it comes to EdTech. And unfortunately, much like Cassandra herself, I'm rarely listened to. I think there is so much exuberance about what EdTech can do. And I like to think of myself as the person who offers a more cautionary look at what EdTech actually can do.
That, I have to say, is one of the things I valued most about reading your book was there's definitely a cautionary element to it, but most importantly was the context, which, you know, for reading it, it's surprising how so much of the context is completely absent from the debate today over EdTech. What was it that led you to write a book about the history of using machinery to teach children?
I'm really interested in history in general, I would say, and I'm always fascinated about how we got here. And I think one of the markers of our particular technological culture is this sort of rejection of history. I talk a lot in the book and in my other work about EdTech amnesia. And I think it's actually almost purposefully cultivated, this idea that not only do we not know about the past, but we kind of even reject the idea of knowing about the past. This is really common, I think, among Silicon Valley entrepreneurs in particular, who like to kind of espouse the notion that because they're wildly ignorant about a subject, and I don't think that's entirely hyperbolic, that because they're so ignorant that somehow that makes them more innovative and better able to tackle problems. And sometimes that they act as though they're the first people to have even noticed that there are problems. And so I'm really interested in sort of how we got to this particular moment in EdTech. And I wanted to tell a different kind of story, one that wasn't simply about the technology itself. I wanted to talk about the people, and I wanted to talk about the people before computers, because I think that that's also really important.
You begin your book in the early 20th century, and you talk about some of the early technologies that were seeking to to change the way that people were taught, and you do so as well by putting it in the context of what was happening in education more generally during that point in American history. I was wondering if you could start us off by talking a bit about what was going on in education generally, and then perhaps introducing us to Sidney Pressey and how he was proposing to change the way that education was being done back then.
Dear Sidney Pressey, one of the stories that we tell about education, and you'll hear this from everybody from secretaries of education to sort of the common sort of man on the street, if you will, is that education hasn't changed in hundreds, sometimes people even say thousands of years, that we're still doing things exactly how we always have been, and hence that's why we need new technologies. And I think it's important to recognize that education, the history of education in the U.S., there has been quite a significant change, but not necessarily in the ways that people are expecting. But I think at the beginning of the 20th century, a lot of things were happening in this country that made people think more about education. After all, public education wasn't that old, and that not everybody was attending school. I mean, people would go to grade school, but it was actually not very common for people to continue on into what we know of now as middle school or high school, let alone into college. But beginning in the early 20th century, there were pushes to get to have people complete high school. And so suddenly we saw more students enrolled in high school. And that meant different kinds of students rather than just the economic elite or people who had specific professional goals in mind. We had an obligation to educate everybody. And that meant also, well, I'll put a little asterisk by everybody. But that meant at the time, a lot of immigrants as well. So there were a lot of pressures on schools to figure out what it meant to offer a standardized education for all Americans, asterisk all. I think it's important to recognize that the experience of African Americans was very different. But there were concerns, of course. If we're going to standardize education for everybody, what happens to individualism? And interestingly, I think this is some of the same discussions that we have today. And that's sort of an undercurrent of my book, is a lot of the things that we talk about today, a lot of the panic we have about education, these are actually quite long-running concerns that we've had. But this idea, if education is standardized, how do we individualize, how do we personalize education? And that's where a lot of these ideas about mechanization came from. And of course, in the early 20th century, that was also the rise of standardized testing as well. And Sidney Pressey, who was an educational psychologist, a professor at Ohio State University, had the sort of brilliant idea that if we could build machines that would both test and teach students, then we would have a better idea of students' capabilities, and we could, in fact, individualize their education for them. And so Sidney Pressey was a tinkerer himself, and he built a prototype of a teaching machine out of old typewriter parts, in which you could offer a student would be posed a question, a multiple choice question, and they would push a button. And if they got the question right, it would move on to the next question. There was another an addition you could add to it, that if they got the question right, it would offer them a candy. That sort of great incentive for children to learn.
I like the connection that you made in the book there between what he's doing and Pavlov, because it sounds so Pavlovian. You rang the bell, Pavlovian. Here's the treat.
Yes, and I think this is at the time, behaviorism was the dominant sort of theory in psychology, in educational psychology. This was how people imagined, or people theorized, that everyone, dogs and humans, learned. So Sidney Pressey got some great reception to his machine. He tried to commercialize it, but unfortunately he ran into a little historical event called the Great Depression. And he really struggled. Dear Sidney struggled sort of valiantly to try to take this machine to market. But of course, you know, during the Great Depression, no one was really interested in either replacing teachers with the machines or actually schools couldn't afford them. They were incredibly expensive. Again, echoes today. How can we possibly afford technology? We've got to continue to employ teachers. So Sidney eventually failed, I think, to bring his machine to market successfully, but he really was and is still seen as sort of the inventor of this idea of using a machine for automating teaching and automating testing as well.
One of the things you do when you talk about the story of Sidney Pressley that I really liked was you point out that this is not simply a binary dynamic. We're not just simply talking about an inventor with the technology and the classroom, that it's a lot more complex, that you have factors of capitalism involved. You're talking about business interests. You're talking about the manufacturing dynamic where I was keep thinking about the letters that Pressley was sending out where he wanted to change this and change that. And they were concerned about the fact that, you know, this would involve even more expense. It would take this already expensive device and make it even more unattainable for school districts.
There's so many interesting challenges to me there. And I think that this is, you know, often how we talk about technology. There's a book by the editor of Wired called What Technology Wants. And I think we often talk about the history of technology as though technology is kind of the driver and it just sort of moves forward of its own volition. And of course, things are so much more complicated than that. And in education, when we talk about technology, we often talk about teachers as being the resistors. And everyone else wants technology in the classroom, but somehow teachers are the ones who are sort of standing in the way of technological progress. And I wanted to show that these are always, not just in the 1920s and 30s, but these are always much more complicated. And this question as well, you know, Sidney Pressley was a scientist. He thought that there was a appropriate, proper, scientific way to build a teaching machine. And the company that he worked with wasn't as interested in the science as they were in, you know, obviously making money. And this conflict between, are we able to have technologies in the classroom that quote unquote work scientifically, that we have research that shows that we can demonstrate that these are effective? And are those the technologies that actually get manufactured? Because are those the technologies that someone, a corporation decides, yeah, we can make that and turn a profit? And certainly, I think that, you know, by telling a nuanced story, you can see that it's much more than just the teacher said no, or the stock market crashed and it didn't work. There are a lot of things going on.
And I think nothing better illustrates that in your book than your chapter where you're talking about Reynold Johnson and Ben Wood and IBM. I was wondering if you could explain that, because that's where you started to talk about technology, that, you know, Pressley is sort of a key figure in terms of trying to mechanize teaching. But you have this new approach coming in initially with Ben Wood, and then you have this surprisingly sustained effort in the 1930s by this major industrial concern to make this a marketable technology.
Ben Wood is a really interesting figure to me, and he's not somebody that people in education history often talk about. I went to the archives at the Educational Testing Service in New Jersey, which is perhaps best known for the GRE or the TOEFL exam. And he was an early founder of that. But he was really interested in educational testing. And as such, he was really he was one of these proponents who said the way in which we're going to understand students better, the way in which we're going to be able to personalize education is to mechanize it, and not in a standardized way, but we'll mechanize it through testing, through all sorts of testing. He had a vision again, sounds very familiar to today. If we can just gather enough data about students, we'll be able to understand them and individualize their education. And for Ben Wood, that meant, of course, intelligence testing, aptitude testing, achievement testing, personality testing. But that required a lot of computational time with humans actually grading the standardized tests. He actually, I think, had his wife help do a lot of the actual number crunching of the standardized tests, the early standardized tests that he administered in Pennsylvania and in New York. And he thought, what if I could get a business to help contribute some calculators for me, computational machinery. And he sent out a bunch of letters saying, I'm doing standardized testing. I would like some help crunching numbers. And none of the corporations were interested except for this one company known as the International Business Machines, IBM, that actually were interested. They donated a computational machine to Ben Wood's research facility at Columbia. And Ben Wood and Thomas Watson, the president of IBM, actually developed a long, long relationship. And Ben Wood realized that with the power of computational machines, you could actually grade tests a lot quicker. And that was sort of the holdup. And so they were looking, IBM was looking for a way to be able to automate test grading. And it's important, I think, to recognize that connection between testing machines and teaching machines. It happened early in the 1920s and 30s, but when we look even at ed tech today, we can really see the connection between standardized testing, both the goals of standardized testing, but also the mode in which it works, the multiple choice test. We can see the way in which that still exists today. It has been quite literally hard-coded into our practices. Reynolds Johnson was a teacher who devised a way to have built a machine that would pick up on the pencil lead and be able to, the machine could sense the pencil lead. We all know these. We've done this, I guess maybe not so much anymore. But you know, people of a certain age are familiar with the number two pencil and coloring little circles. And those can be fed into a machine in order to, you know, automatically grade your test. And this was an invention of Reynolds Johnson, who was, after some time, hired by IBM. He actually had a very long career at IBM as an inventor. But this idea of being able to automate testing was really important to the development of educational psychology, but also the development of educational technology. Can we automate grading? Can we automate assessment? And then how does that connect to the kinds of things that we do when we are building machines that teach?
One of the figures who really looms large in your book is B.F. Skinner. And I was wondering if you could explain a bit about who he is and how it is that he gets involved in this question of automating teaching, and how he comes to be such a large figure in the effort to do so after World War II.
B.F. Skinner is a huge figure. I would say he is, perhaps with the exception of Sigmund Freud, probably the most famous figure in psychology. I think that a lot of people, even if you've never taken a psychology class in college, even if you aren't familiar with psychology, probably know the name of B.F. Skinner, know a little bit, or have perhaps a stereotypical view of the kinds of things that Skinner did with operant conditioning, his work with pigeons, for example, being able to offer people offer pigeons rewards in order to train them to do certain behaviors. And B.F. Skinner in the mid-20th century was probably one of the best-known public intellectuals. He was on the cover of magazines. He was in the newspaper. He was on television. He was, you know, he would be one of the guests on talk shows, for example. this was a very, very well-known individual. And one of the things that Skinner, one of the many projects that Skinner worked on was the development of the teaching machine. His name is probably most closely associated with teaching machines. Skinner had a story that I think if he were alive today, he would present as a TED Talk. And it's just the story that he told and gets told time and time again about how he had this aha moment for why it was necessary to mechanize education. He visited his daughter's fourth grade class one day. The students were in a math lesson, and he observed the students sort of working, and he noticed that some students made it through the math lesson very quickly and then were bored, and some students really struggled, and they fidgeted around and were distracted, and the teacher did her best walking up and down the aisle, helping students when she could. And then at the end of the math lesson, she collected everyone's papers, took them home, and then the idea was that she would grade them and bring them back the next day. And for Skinner, this violated all of the principles that he believed in for how learning best happens. And for Skinner, this was immediate positive behavioral reinforcement. He said, there's no way that when you get a paper back the next day, your grade back the next day, whether you've got an A or an F, you're not going to learn from that because it's not an immediate reinforcement of what you've just done. And he thought that, you know, it would require students. He thought there had to be a way that students could, if they were doing well, could move forward at their own pace. Again, moving at their own pace is something we hear a lot about today in education technology. And so he went home, he built a little box out of wood, a prototype of a teaching machine in which a student would have a math question. And if they got the question right, they could reveal the answer. If they got the question right, it would immediately move them on to the next question. A little side note, the reward for Skinner, unlike Pressey, who actually offered a child a piece of candy, the reward for Skinner was you get to move on to the next question. I think we might debate whether or not that's actually a reward in math class. Yay, I get to take the next question. But this was sort of Skinner's basic idea. And again, he really thought that this was the sort of the way in which we would transform American education, that rather than students sort of in a classroom all together waiting for the teacher to move on, that they would be able to move at their own pace through lessons, and that students who struggled wouldn't be punished by getting lost or being left behind, that they would have an opportunity to work at their own pace at the precise level they were at. And so, much like Sidney Pressey, Skinner worked very hard to try to bring this idea to market, to try to commercialize the teaching machine.
I just keep thinking back to how familiar all that sounds, that students can move at their own pace, that instruction is individualized. And you point out in your book how that's always how they're presenting it, is that this is going to make the teacher's job easier, that teachers are going to be freed from a lot of the drudgery. It's almost like the idea that if you make it an industrial line process, then people are free to do more creative things and be more effective as people rather than themselves being reduced to machines. And you point out time and again that how that conflicts with a lot of the other concerns about how this is about, effectively, turning, the entire educational process into a very industrialized and mechanized one in which a lot of that element of humanity is lost.
Yes, one of my favorite things I discovered were the students actually at Ohio State University responding to Professor Pressey's invention, saying, wait a minute, like, it doesn't matter if you automate the testing. This is actually drudgery for us as students. We would like to invent a test-taking machine. If you're going to automate the grading of tests, how about we automate the taking of tests? I mean, I think that this is the thing that I think a lot of these inventors, and still today, sort of haven't got their heads around, that it's actually not particularly exciting to move through lessons at this kind of incremental step-by-step way. I actually, when I was researching the book, I thought I should try this for myself. I want to experience what one of these machines were like. I was, you know, very curious. And of course, if you go on eBay, you can find all sorts of I could spend a ton of money. You can find all sorts of very cool old devices. And I bought a teaching machine that was sold by a company called TMI Inc., Teaching Machines Inc. I bought a little plastic teaching machine and a packet of Introduction to Electricity. And it was so dull because the idea of Skinner and of programmed instruction, which is eventually the sort of this practice that developed out of this, was that you reduce, because you want to minimize mistakes, right? You only want positive reinforcement. So you reduce everything down to the sort of smallest little learning object, the little smallest nugget of knowledge, and then move students very slowly, step by step forward, so that they're never making a mistake, so that there's only positive reinforcement. And I got to tell you, that's boring. Or at least it's very tedious, is probably the, you know. And so I worked my way through, I think, a page and a half of Introduction to Electricity and thought, whew, there's no way. There's, you know, I mean, I don't even know if a candy dropping out of the side would have encouraged me to complete it. But I think that that's, you know, that this idea that these machines, eliminate drudgery for the teacher or for the student, I just don't think that that's shown to be the case. And it's interesting when you look at the kinds of things that students are assigned to do today. There's on the iPad or the computer, they're very similar. There's a lot of bells and whistles, a lot of animation that happens when you get a question right. But it's at the same time, it's still a lot of drudgery for students to work their way through these worksheets, whether they're digital or whether they're scrolling through paper on a teaching machine.
You also highlight something else in the book, which is I think very interesting, which is how when you have these incredibly smart people. I mean, nobody's going to doubt, you know, people like, you know, Wood and Johnson and Skinner as you know, not having brain power. They definitely do. But when they develop these processes, they have a great idea. And you describe how time and again they put it together and they work with these other smart people. And you never really hear a lot about at a point when they're, you know, proposing the idea or working on the idea, that they bring in teachers or that they consult students beyond just piloting it with them to make sure that it's working and has the desired result out of the machine itself.
This is so true. And actually I think that when students are imagined as being both students and teachers are sort of imagined as not having any sort of agency or input, I think that that's, you know, again, the way in which we tell the story of technology, as though the technology just builds upon itself and it happens to students. It happens to teachers, but they aren't agents in the construction of it. And I think that that's a particular way of thinking about education, thinking about teaching and learning, that in the 60s, I think folks really started to resist quite vocally and develop a very fully articulated vision of an alternative to this sort of standardized, mechanized vision. And it was one in which students were seen as being creators of and part of a community and scholars themselves and wanting to develop their own ideas and not just be programmed. I mean, and that is, you know, programmed instruction, teaching machines, perhaps it's easier for us to sort of see in that the kind of standardization, the kind of engineering that these folks had in mind. But I think that it's still very much the kind of engineering that people today, that entrepreneurs, edtech entrepreneurs have in mind today. You know, Mark Zuckerberg talks about personalized learning, but I don't think that it's a practice of freedom, which is something that in the 60s students were starting to really articulate, that they wanted their educational experience to be a practice of freedom and agency. And of course, that's antithetical to B.F. Skinner's ideas as he developed them along the same time.
And as you describe in the book, Skinner also benefited from a development, which of course he couldn't foresee, which is this massive focus you have nationally on education in the late 1950s, especially with Sputnik, that all of a sudden you have this existential anxiety about America falling behind and how we need to do more about education. And it struck me that while Skinner's working on this, 3-4 years before Sputnik takes off, that nonetheless, he really does catch this wave where all of a sudden there's this, you know, there's this desire to improve education, to spend a lot of money on it. And he's right there. And, you know, nobody's really thinking about Pressey anymore or IBM's efforts. They're now thinking about what this, you know, this leading public intellectual has already been working on and how this is going to solve the problem and allow America to catch up again.
Yes, I think, you know, post-World War II America, Cold War America, was really committed to gadgetry. And I think that that's one of the things that, for me, makes Skinner also quite interesting, not just the teaching machines, but some of his other inventions that I explore in the book as well. You know, but this question of, do we really want to gadgetize? Do we want to gadgetize our future? Gadgetize, I don't know if that's a word. But I think that there was a real push, particularly after Sputnik, to do that to education. And we saw, you know, science, technology, math and foreign languages as being the areas that American students really were falling behind their Soviet peers. Whether that's true or not, that was certainly the story that we were telling. And a lot of money went into education technology, teaching machines, but also this was a time of an expansion of the use of film in schools, for example, and television. We were the early development, I think, of computers as well. We were absolutely committed to education becoming this more technological endeavor, and Skinner was absolutely there to try to convince people that that's what the future was going to look like. There were a lot of sort of sci-fi visions, and not necessarily, you know, fiction per se, but a lot of visions of the future in that period in which we were certain that education was going to be very sort of Jetsons looking, robot teachers and students interacting with machinery versus being in a classroom.
I was wondering if you could perhaps describe some of the efforts that were taking place during this period. Like, how were they trying to turn Skinner's approach into reality? And what were some of the efforts they tried to implement to pilot this? And what ultimately caused those efforts to come to an end?
So Skinner himself, much like Sidney Pressey, was wildly unsuccessful at actually having a commercial success, which is it's so fascinating because he was the best known individual, the name most closely associated with this, but he was really adamant about the proper use of behaviorism, the proper development of the machines. And a lot like Pressey, I think, struggled to communicate that effectively with the company that he worked with. That said, a lot of other people, many of whom were Skinner's students or actually his students or people that he'd worked with, were less committed to this, you know, to being, or less strict about, you know, what the machines had to look like, how they would function. And they were much more successful at getting things to market, one of which was the company that I bought my machine, Teaching Machines Inc. They worked with encyclopedia companies, for example, that were quite popular in the 60s, going door to door, peddling sets of encyclopedias. If you bought a set of encyclopedias, they'd throw in a teaching machine as well. So we saw a lot in that period of at home use, right? And so this might be someone learning, like I did, well, like I tried, Introduction to Electricity. You know, take a at-home course with a teaching machine on electricity and join this growing new profession, technological profession. a lot of stuff in the back of Popular Mechanics, selling people courses to be taken at home via teaching machines. Again, very familiar stuff with what we have today. But there were pilot programs in schools. There were schools that adopted teaching machines. The best known was in Roanoke, in Virginia. They tried to do it sort of. They had a pilot program in which at first one class and then a whole grade would use the teaching machines in lieu of having a traditional algebra class. And at first, I think, and this is quite common, the students liked it. They parents were a little concerned. There was no homework. The students moved at their own pace. The teachers only intervened if students asked for help. But Roanoke, Virginia was sort of the best known. And I think if you look at the media coverage, really the one that most newspapers touted when they said, teaching machines are the future. And here's our one example. Again and again, it would be, and they're doing it in Roanoke, therefore it must be great. So that's really the place that most folks, including Skinner. Skinner was very pleased. He visited the schools at Roanoke, saw them using the teaching machines. They weren't using the ones that he tried to develop, but he was still very pleased with the pilot program in Roanoke. But you know, I think, and this is again, I as I was writing the book, I wanted to write at the end of almost every paragraph, and this is exactly what it's like today. You know, I think that after a while, sort of the newness of these technologies kind of wears off. People start asking more questions. It's less exciting to be the cutting edge school that's trying these things. I think that it just didn't really pan out, I think, the way in which they wanted. Of course, computers were on the horizon. It was expensive. It was still incredibly expensive to buy a teaching machine for every student. And then, of course, you had to buy, these were paper-based, so you had to buy the packets, the worksheet packets that went in with them. So some school districts, in fact, Roanoke itself, said, you know, we're not going to use the machine. We're just going to use these workbook packets. And I think that, you know, many people sort of who went to school in the 70s and early 80s are probably really familiar with programmed instruction. We just didn't use the teaching machine, but we used the very similar kinds of packets that were meant to be sort of a personalized learning experience that you moved at your own pace through reading packets or through math packets rather than the sort of whole classroom instruction. So my argument is that, you know, teaching machines, they didn't just sort of die out. They didn't just go away per se. They actually became part of this other practice. And as computers were developed in the 1960s, the early educational software that was developed for computers was absolutely based on these kind of Skinnerist principles. And still today, much of what we see in software, in educational software, looks a lot like the kinds of things that students were doing in the 60s. That the animation is better, but really the principles behind the principles of programmed instruction, these sort of small units of content, moving students slowly to sort of maximize their success, that's absolutely still with us.
And yet, as you describe, it's not a single trajectory. That's unbroken. That you, as you've already alluded to, in the late 1960s, you start to see a backlash against a lot of the ideas that are underlying Skinner's behavioralist approach. That there is a sense that the regimentation is something that is actually to be opposed. You start seeing that opposition. To what degree is it being triggered by a lot of this educational technology? And to what degree is it more of a reflection of the more general backlash or turning away from just the whole idea of behavioralism in psychological thought and in educational psychology in particular?
I would say it's a little column A, a little column B. I mean, I think that there were, you know, Skinner, like I said, Skinner was such a well-known figure, and the trajectory of Skinner's own career, I think, took a little bit of a different turn when he published his book Beyond Freedom and Dignity, in which he specifically argued against the idea of freedom, against the idea of dignity. And so this was in some ways, for a lot of people, I think this was sort of like the final straw for seeing Skinner as being a positive figure. And I think today, when you mention Skinner's name, a lot of people have a very negative opinion of Skinner, which whether they've read any of his material or not. Interestingly, a lot of folks, I think, I mean, if you take a psychology class, for example, you know, the way in which the chapters or the history is organized, it's very clear that sort of we had psychoanalysis, and then we moved to behaviorism or, you know, positivism, and then behaviorism. And then we've moved beyond behaviorism to, you know, cognitive science. I would argue that we haven't really necessarily left behaviorism behind, particularly not in educational psychology. I think behaviorism is very strong, and I think it's very strong in technology. But with the popular view, Skinner definitely fell out of favor. The most folks, I think, were familiar with, even if they hadn't read Skinner's work, they were pretty familiar with a movie called Clockwork Orange, which came out time as Beyond Freedom and Dignity, and made a very convincing case as to why this kind of behavioral engineering that Skinner really touted was dangerous, shall we say. It coincided with the rise of, I think, a lot of the student movement, and students expressing their own deep dissatisfaction with the educational system, which they saw as being mechanized, standardized, and the educational technologies and the practices that Skinner had sort of touted, Skinner and others had touted, were really seen as dehumanizing. And in order to sort of rehumanize education, students wanted to reject this, the kind of teaching practices, the theories, and very, and quite literally the machinery that they saw as dehumanizing them.
So a lot of the momentum behind it was lost, but the consequences were still very much there and still very much influencing the development of educational technology.
I think so. I think that when you look at the development of computing and the development of educational technology go hand in hand, right? So, you know, universities were, of course, the place in where, you know, computers were, that's where you'd find a computer. That's where computing was developed. And so while there was computer science, you know, for the sake of the science itself at these universities, there was a lot of work in developing ways in which computers could teach. And so, and like I said, this, much of this was just really a furtherance of the kinds of things that Skinner and others were doing with their plastic and wooden devices. So educational computing, educational technology really is this, I think, is this continuation of the sort of behaviorist technology that Skinner and others had developed earlier in the 20th century. I don't think it's not as unbroken as we like to tell the story. We like to say, thank goodness the cognitive scientists came along, because now we don't do that nasty behaviorism any longer. But I think the nasty behaviorism is very much part of the foundation of what we continue to build our educational technologies upon.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
So if you read the book, when you read the book, that there's Skinner. I don't know why Skinner, I mean, I should put Skinner to rest, bless his heart, but Skinner had this other invention the heir crib, this idea that he could raise his daughter, raise his baby in a crib that was better designed for sort of the ideal engineering of an infant. And I've been really fascinated with this particular device, but also with the kinds of ways in which engineering of children, engineering of infants, in the 20th century. So I'm working on a new book on the development of the baby monitor, which similarly seems like a technology that's a contemporary technology, but has its origins in the early 20th century with the Lindbergh baby kidnapping. This idea that children must be monitored, children must be surveilled, children are in danger, and they need this sort of technological intervention to protect and save them. So there's a theme in my work.
Well, it sounds like a fascinating book, and I hope that when it's published, that we can have you back on the show to talk about
Definitely.
It.
Definitely. This has been great. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Audrey Waters, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
You too. Thank you.